From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from around the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell that smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. And now, it's time for your weekly roundup in news coverage. Every Wednesday, we welcome a couple people onto the show who are really into politics. We call them the Dakota Political Junkies. This week, we welcomed John Schaff. He's a professor of political science at Northern State University, and former South Dakota State Senator Tom Dempster. They joined Lori for a discussion about some of the things going on in the state legislature this week and the reactions of a couple big-name South Dakota politicians to President Trump's State of the Union address. Let's take a listen.
Tom Dempster, Senator John Thune, was on with Judy Woodruff in PBS NewsHour, and she was asking him about, the popularity or lack of popularity of impeachment. And he hearkened back to the Clinton era, and he said, you know, when we were impeaching Clinton, we lost some points. And he gained. He was more popular, and we were less popular, and he expects the same pattern to play out, that President Trump will be more popular and Democrats will be less popular. Is that just the nature of the game?
I saw John Thune having that conversation last night with Judy Woodruff. And I saw how talented John Thune was, very much along the strain of George McGovern, very much along the strain of Tom Daschle, very much along the strain of Dennis Dugard. And here's the responsibility of a leader such as a John Thune, in my opinion, is he had the capacity, as was demonstrated last night, to devour, almost as if he was eating a smorgasbord, to devour all of the controversy that was in Judy Woodruff's question, and to consume it and digest it and come back with his statements, typically with the sense of equanimity that we revere in our respected political leaders in South Dakota, and came back with a sense of calm that said, all of this is really tough, but we're going to be okay. It's not what he said, but that's what you could see in his statement. That's a powerful thing.
He looked relaxed during the State of the Union. He was chewing gum. He had a smile on his face. He looked to me, and that's a value judgment, but when I saw his face, I thought he looks more relaxed than he has in the last couple weeks.
He certainly is a man like many of our best political leaders that is comfortable in his own skin. Yeah. But he also demonstrates that he has the capacity of taking all of our ills, all of the controversy, such as last night, upon his shoulders and bearing them and coming back to us and saying, we're going to be fine. That's real skill. And John, I would argue, you would know this far better than me. You are the third Lincoln biographer that I've met. President Lincoln certainly had that kind of capacity of bearing all of that grief of the nation and all of that hatred and all of that ill will and coming back and saying, we're going to be fine.
John Schaff, any thoughts on Senator Thune and the way forward?
Well, I think what Tom is getting at, I think obviously John Thune is a very talented politician. I think what I've seen from John Thune, his major talent is what Tom was saying about Lincoln made me think of this, is the ability to take very complicated things and sometimes very controversial things and to state his point of view in a way that is easy to understand, so to make the complex understandable, but also in a way that he comes off, and I think this is also a talent Tom Daschle typically had, is to come off as with a moderate disposition. Obviously, neither Tom Daschle nor John Thune had what we'd think of as moderate politics. You know, they're not, especially Thune is not a political centrist. But the ability to say things in a way that doesn't poke at the other side or can come off as in a way that everybody can agree with or most people can find agreeable. And I think that's a great talent that John Thune has.
Let's transition to talk about Dusty Johnson, Congressman Dusty Johnson, because he is, you know, this is his first term in Congress, and now he has more than one primary challenger at home. Liz Marty May from Kyle, South Dakota, I think.
Yep.
I got to figure out exactly
right.
where she's from. Okay, thank
that
you.
That is correct.
Yep, she's a rancher and business owner from Kyle, has cast her hat in the ring and come out with a campaign ad that pretty much says it's time to cull the herd and get Dusty Johnson out of there, and she's the better choice. John Schaaf, let's start with you. This is a, you know, he's certainly not, Dusty Johnson is certainly not new to South Dakota politics. He is new to Congress, and now a challenge from Skylar Borglum and Liz May, just from, Republican side. That's not counting Dan Hollis.
I think Skylar Borglum is challenging Mike Rounds.
You're right. Yes. I got that wrong. Yep. Yep. Everybody's looking at me, waving at me.
Exactly. Liz May, I think exactly. This sort of goes back to what I was talking about Donald Trump's popularity in the state. What would possess a Republican to primary Dusty Johnson? I think as we went through our election a couple years ago, the primary election with Dusty Johnson, he came off as amongst the three major candidates there in the Republican primary as the more moderate, common sense, if you will, mainstream Republican. That was sort of the where he positioned himself. In office, he's had a couple votes, for example, on constitutional authority with immigration, where Dusty Johnson voted against the interest of the Trump administration. And I think that has bothered certain people in the state. And so you see, it seems like Liz May is coming from the more conservative wing of the party. And that whole cull the herd metaphor that she's creating in her ad seems to suggest that Dusty Johnson is a weak calf, if you will. He's the weak link in the herd and needs to be separated from the herd. And so there's a certain weakness in Dusty Johnson. I think that weakness is probably is he is insufficiently supportive of Donald Trump. And one of the things I've noticed over the last, I don't know, say month, 6 weeks or so in Dusty Johnson's public statements and what he puts out for public consumption is I think he's trying to tout more his support for Donald Trump and Trump's agenda, to wit his statement on the State of the Union from last night was very strong in support of the president. And I think he recognizes that this could possibly be a weakness with him, although I think he's probably politically quite strong within the party. He's very well funded and he's got the leadership of the Republican Party. There's a reason why Dusty Johnson got the nomination last time, is because the by and large, the leadership of the Republican Party is in Dusty Johnson's corner. But better safe than sorry, correct? So I think we're going to see him stepping up his verbal appreciation of the president.
Yeah. He also said the economy is hotter than a pistol. And when you listen to the language of Liz May's, of her ad, there's a lot of, lingo in there. There's a lot of references to, how we live our lives. How do we speak? How do we talk about ourselves? Tom Dempster, thoughts on a Republican challenger to Dusty Johnson?
Full disclaimer, as a Republican, I've supported Dusty Johnson. I've supported Dusty Johnson because I considered him to be a man of strength, considered him to be a man of character, and considered him to be a man that would seek solutions. I've been particularly watchful or particularly enjoyed him under all of this pressure that you undergo, actually serving in that office. And what I see, I'm impressed with. There are certainly some members of the far right. There would certainly be some members of the Republican Party that would say 100% Trump or die. I don't think that will sustain itself, but there are certainly parts of Republican Party that believe that and express that. And I would guess, I don't know, but I would guess this is an expression of that.
Yeah. Dusty Johnson, was pretty involved in the USMCA trade agreement, spoke out as that being a great success, and with the ranchers really not loving USMCA because it doesn't include country of origin labeling. You also wonder about ranchers in this state and if they're feeling heard in Washington. And the results of what happens next for that. Let's talk a little bit about state, what's happening in the state house. A few things that are, you know, pretty, you know, I guess predictable in some ways. And where do you want to start, John Schaaf? Anything from our list of possible topics that comes to mind that we should make sure we get to first?
Well, I think what we're seeing is it's a big week because, you know, people have to have their bills filed this week, and some things are coming out of the woodwork. Some things are going to fly. Some, I suspect, will not. You know, some of these things are relatively small things. You know, we saw yesterday there was a vote on daylight savings, and it was a tie vote in the House, and so that effectively kills it, whether we go to permanent daylight savings. I guess those are the sort of things that are intriguing, not earth-shattering.
But before we move off that, we have to quote Skylar Borglum, and she was quoted in the Argus Leader when they were talking about the debate over daylight savings time. And just, you know, if you could pick the best thing to come out of a lawmaker's mouth all week, as far as quotable for the newspaper for broadcast, is her saying, let's not pretend like the economy will shut down and unicorns are going to start flying and we're going to lose our sense of purpose on this planet. So everybody calm down about daylight savings time.
Unicorns and hotter than a pistol. eloquent politicians.
John, I don't know about you, and Lori, I don't know about you, but I absolutely enjoy the 25 hours we have in the day of daylight savings time.
Yeah. This was the large, best day of the year.
This was a large argument about kids, West River, East River, kids waiting for the bus, kids coming home in the darkness. We're just cranky about the weather at this time of year, I think. And the fact that this was tied is interesting to me, too.
I will say, I think that House Ag is going to hear the hemp bill tomorrow. I think it's been on the schedule a couple times, and I don't know why it's been delayed, but I don't know if they're working on some things. So right now, I think there's always very controversial subjects. We've got things about LGBT rights. We've got surrogacy bills, which I'm interested in, but we've got Fred Deutsch and his transgendered bill. These make a lot of news, but when it comes down to it, I think probably what people are going to pay attention to are things like hemp, which is kind of a major bill that can have a big effect in our state. Then as we get close to the end of session, it's how are we going to pay our bills when they actually put a budget together and we start to see final revenue projections and spending projections. And so, I mean, Tom knows this way better than any of us do, is that a lot of the real action in the legislature is usually backloaded because that's when they're making real decisions about what we're going to spend our money on.
Yeah. When we were out in Pierre, Tom, the governor had done her State of the State and said, you know, she was motivated to get the increases for the big three, the teachers, the state employees, Medicaid providing, you know, reimbursement. Republican leaders said, we got to get that money done for the big three. Democratic leaders said, we got to get that money. They were talking about appropriations then. Where do you sort of see the State House kind of curving next as they get their bills in and some of the, you know, sort of flashier legislation falls by the wayside or moves forward? Do you agree with John that it's really all about the money in a lot of ways?
Yes and no. Let me talk just for a second about transgender stuff and the kind of purposes that bills like that serve. I always used to be irritated as a legislator when bills like that would come about because they tend to clear the deck in terms of media. Nothing else matters other than these bills. But let's talk about that, and here's why. I mean, we have legislators from Sioux Falls that drive 240 miles to Pierre from Rapid City, 210 miles. It is the great convening place. This is the place that we argue public policy. I look at legislation as if you're a gold miner and you're constantly shaking your, what do you call that thing? You're constantly panning for gold, shaking your pan, and you're hoping that you find that nugget of gold. What these transgender bills do is they bring about problems that most people know nothing about, and they put them through a public process that helps people to understand that. So as much as I was irritated by bills such as this that sweep the deck, it's also a public process of discourse, a public process of debate, where many of those issues become understood and become settled. So I can't help but see that dynamic that seems to happen every year in the legislature.
Yeah.
Relative to matters of public policy in the state, relative to financial matters, ultimately, in the last days of the legislature, I've never been a believer in zero-sum games. But ultimately, when it comes in the last days of the legislature, it does become a zero-sum game where somebody gets this funding and somebody doesn't get this funding.
I'm going to ask you more about that in just a minute. We do have to pause for a quick break. John Schaff, you'll stick with us here for a minute?
Absolutely.
We'll be right back with more with the Dakota Political Junkies on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking politics today with Tom Dempster in the Sioux Falls studio and John Schaff in the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio in Aberdeen. And Tom, I'm hoping you can pick up where we were right before the break, because we were talking about these sort of zero-sum legislation and appropriation. Keep going on that thought, please.
South Dakota is a very conservative place. South Dakota has one of the lowest tax liabilities in the entire country. For some reason, inappropriately so, we seem to celebrate that rather than addressing some of our much-needed necessities. There is a bias in the legislature to have a balanced budget, and by a balanced budget, I mean for the incoming revenue to balance with the outgoing expenses, not borrowing from any of the trust funds, not taking money from here, but income has to meet expenses. Here's the way ultimately that it works. Every appropriation, every bill that impacts the budget has one of two categories. One, it's either a spender, meaning that's additional expenditures, or it's a bleeder. And the bleeder is, here comes a bill that wants to, for example, exempt food from the sales tax. That's going to cost us, what, 27 or 30% of our sales tax revenue. That's a bleeder. There's a significant amount of pressure if you are a spender or if you are a bleeder to be defeated so that you have the capacity of maintaining the budget projections, of maintaining that actual income coming in from the actual expenses leaving. Do not have your bill be classified spender, bleeder.
This is why the bill to remove the tax on guns fell so quickly in committee this week. That's a bleeder, huh?
I think that's a bleeder.
I think they had the math.
I think that's a bleeder. And I'm going to suspect that there are other issues there
right.
as well.
Yeah, we had some good tape from that yesterday of that conversation is why it's fresh in my mind. John, I want to expand here on something that Tom said about these bills that sort of clear the decks. Broadly speaking, are these also the bills that engage people in the process in a way that's healthy? Is there any, because it just seems like there are, or are they just pure distractions that cause division? How do you sort of see some of these, you know, social bills that surprise people and cause, you know, really get a lot of news coverage?
Of course, those don't have to be mutually exclusive. But I think one thing, and Tom's right about this, is that, you know, up here in Aberdeen at our two Cracker Barrels, one of which I was at this past weekend and the previous weekend I just read about in the news, these are the issues that have dominated the discussion. We had a very interesting discussion about the surrogacy bill, 1096, that it seemed like maybe even some minds were changed one way or the other on that bill as a couple who had gone through surrogacy was there and spoke their minds. But one of the things that impressed me was that, you know, a couple of our legislators from districts 2 and 3 mentioned that, you know, one thing about our legislature is that every single bill gets a hearing. That means no matter how obscure it might seem to you, no matter how much of a waste of time it may seem to you, anybody who can get a legislator to sponsor a bill, they at least get a day before a committee. And maybe this year there's this bill or that bill that you think is silly and is a waste of the legislature's time. But next year it might be your bill that only affects a small number of people, that doesn't seem that important to folks, but they all get a hearing, and that's a good thing. And so that's part of, so we have discussion both at the legislature, but it's also what people are talking about at the Cracker Barrel here in Aberdeen, for example. Sometimes I wish that some of this discourse was a little bit more high-minded than it sometimes is. But nonetheless, it's at least discourse, and it's a way of us talking about these things that are very important to us as a people. And that's a good thing. My only point is that I think when it comes down to the thing that the legislature really spends the most of its time on, usually tends to be bread and butter issues. And that is the kind of thing that tends to be backloaded. And that's where the real attention is ultimately going to end up being.
Tom, John mentioned hemp legislation. What's going on behind the scenes? Because last session, this was such a dramatic behind the scenes playing out with the governor and lawmakers. And much work was done over the summer. And now we're back. She's issued her, her guardrails, her guidelines for the legislation. She mentioned it in the State of the State. What's happening now behind the scenes as people talk about hemp in PIR? Can you predict anything based on your experience?
Oh, Lori, thank you for giving me that, whatever you just gave me. But I have absolutely no idea what's happening behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But I do know that for certain, the legislature has made a statement that this shall be. The governor has certainly made a statement that this shall be under only these circumstances. I'm going to guess that the legislature will prevail.
There's a bill making its way through the South Dakota legislature that seeks to prohibit cities and municipalities from banning plastic straws, bags, and other single-use containers. That's a ban on bans. Now, people have become passionate about this topic, to say the least. Stephanie Arney is a conservationist and a wildlife educator. She joined Lori to discuss her take on Senate Bill 54. That's the bill causing all this commotion.
Stephanie Arney, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I got to give you the whole background of what's been happening on In the Moment with plastic straws and bags.
Oh,
it's one of those things, every time you bring it up with somebody, they just have this very strong reaction. And I was at a hotel out in Rapid City for the show last week, I think, and I was at the restaurant and people were at the bar and they were getting extra straws. Put their foot down and say, like, this is something that I'm going to do. And they were irritated, but they was talking about this notion of straws and, people sort of, taking them away from them. And everyone I talked to is pretty upset about it on one end or the other, but they don't always know what's pushing their buttons on the reason why. So before we get, I wanted to give you that background as to like kind of what's happening here in South Dakota with the conversation. But let's start with the bill itself, because this is also something you've been seeking out input on social media and saying, hey, let's have a conversation about this. And you've been getting some pretty interesting responses. So the bill itself, what do you know about what some of the supporters are arguing, why we need this ban on bans?
Okay, so I spent a lot of time researching this, but just like everybody else, sometimes I'm doing the best I can to, really get to credible people and to hear both sides of the story.
Yeah.
There's no way that we can ever come to a compromise unless we listen to each other, we put down our egos, and we see ourselves as individuals and our individual communities and what is important to us. And so I hope you guys can hear me out and hear my perspective and take it or leave it.
We create that space on In the Moment just really intentionally. We're in that safe space together. Go ahead.
Okay, so from what I'm aware of, the state of South Dakota has already prohibited a ban on things like garbage bags. They want to expand it to prohibit anyone in the state, or specifically stores and restaurants, from banning plastic straws and auxiliary containers, which include bags, cans, cups, bottles, packages, and other containers. I'm not seeing their definition of plastic. Once they really get into the nitty-gritty, they're going to have to describe the chemicals, because we all know that there's There's 2, 5, 7. There's right. many different types of plastic ingredients. So I think of it like we all know that there is flour in many different types of cakes and pastries, but it's the same with plastic. And so some of them are more recyclable than the others. Some of them take more energy. Some have more chemicals. Some are thicker. Some are medical grade. So I'll be intrigued to hear more about that. But I think it's they're pretty much including any just convenience, single-use plastics. And for the most part, a lot of those are not recycled and are easily recyclable. So what I'm hearing is that supporters of this bill are wanting this to happen. They feel passionately about it because they're afraid that if people on the other side that want to ban plastic are getting all up in arms and are super passionate because they saw one sea turtle with a straw up its nose, that they're going to ban plastic without considering South Dakota business owners, especially those in rural areas or moms and pops groups, and considering how inexpensive these items are for their establishments, and then if they become too expensive, that it will actually hurt not just that business, but South Dakota's economy, and possibly South Dakota wouldn't be able to contribute more to the national economy. I'm also hearing that it creates challenges for individuals that are part of the disabled community who rely on specifically plastic straws for food. And I'm under the impression from living in states like Hawaii and California in my travels for working in conservation that even when we do ban single-use plastics, sometimes businesses will find loopholes for alternative plastics. So if we ban plastic 2s, then we're going to switch our bags to thicker plastics, like plastic 7, for an example, and say that it's a reusable bag, even though people still treat it as though it's a throwaway bag. Right. So we do need to consider those things. And it seems as though those individuals that have introduced this idea and support it are really passionate, the most passionate about the business owners. Of course, I could be wrong, but that's my understanding.
I think that's what we're hearing here as well, that they want a consistency. And even for large businesses, they're saying, you know, you don't want a patchwork of legislation and regulations across state lines and in different cities and in the state. So if you have a, you know, a Target store in Sioux Falls and you have one in Rapid City and Sioux Falls has said you can't use single-use plastic bags, then that creates an entire challenge for a large corporation. And, you know, the argument then is people won't want to bring their businesses to different cities in South Dakota because we've made it more difficult. Let's talk about plastic itself, though, because you say plastic, it's hard to deny, because one of the reasons this issue came up was because after the flooding in the spring, the Big Sioux River here in Sioux Falls was like a plastic bag forest. You could look out and just see, hundreds, I guess. I'm throwing that number out kind of casually, but it sure seemed like hundreds of plastic bags just in the trees everywhere. Tell me about why plastics can be a problem. What's on the other side of this story?
Okay, so yeah, that's the biggest issue. Opponents on the other side are trying to decrease the amount of trash piling up in our landfills and at our recycling centers to try to nip it in the bud so that there isn't littering or trash flying off of garbage trucks into our streams. This is something I want to make very clear. This isn't just to protect wildlife from, entanglement and choking and poison. It's also to consider human health. And that's really where I'm coming from. When I speak on this topic, and I want to dig in that in just a second, but I also want to recognize the people that also aren't taking a big stand on their belief with plastic, but instead are saying this should be taken up by cities instead of the state. So let's get into the plastic thing. 5 trillion pieces of plastic litter our oceans right now. We have 5 gyres, which are just really big. Think of hurricanes in the ocean. Currents come together and push plastic together from all continents. And I've been in them. I've seen them. They're pretty horrific, actually. And So this plastic is coming from all over the world. I've found pieces on beaches, and while I'm filming sharks in the ocean or whales or whatever I'm working with, I've had to push plastic from other countries and things from even like 1980s. I've seen Barbie dolls floating in there. I'm like, I think that's my Barbie from 1985.
She's back, yeah.
Yeah, she's back. They have, the newest data is 22 million pounds of plastic enters the Michigan lakes every single year. I know microplastics has been a big issue in our Michigan lakes because plastic never really disintegrates. I've heard a couple senators that are for this bill that have said that plastic is better for our gardens and our soil, and that is unfortunately not true. And it is very harmful. It is full of chemicals that leaches into our soil, into our seeds, into our food that we eat, into the animals that we eat. And Lake Michigan is finding many pieces of microplastics inside of their fish and their birds as well. And again, this goes into the trout and walleye, into mallards, into deer, and now we are finding it in our bodies. And there's still a lot of research being done on that, but they are finding microplastics in our body and levels of chemicals that are in the plastics in our body because we are also consuming this now because it's so prevalent in our ecosystem.
Sure.
And then, of course, the one that I believe, Lori, that is really getting everybody super passionate when you say, what is really pushing people's buttons? It's amazing. It's not always the facts that I just told you. Mm-hmm. It's more so that they've seen videos of animals that I've worked with and rescued in the past that have been choking on animals or on plastic, excuse me, or are entangled in it. And it's hard, especially those cute, cuddly animals. You know, people see those animals and their faces, and it really strikes a chord with them. They picture their dog choking on plastic, and it really just hits home, and they can't see it anymore. It hurts too much. And I think that's what just sends them over the line. And when you see those things, it sometimes becomes harder to listen to the other side. And if you're somebody who's passionate about the economy of South Dakota and our businesses being sustainable and bringing in big companies like Target, you're very passionate about that. And it's hard to consider, you know, a couple animals. It's 100 million animals that are killed each year from plastics, and I think it's harder to picture that. So I think that's really what's pushing buttons for a lot of people.
Yeah. I've had a hard time understanding as we walked into this debate, why it would cost businesses money. And the idea that you have different, you know, regulations in different cities makes some kind of sense to me, but I don't think there's any requirement that if your store doesn't provide plastic bags, that they have to provide a different kind of bag. And in some ways that goes back to, if we're all bringing our own reusable bags everywhere we go, doesn't everyone save money? I know our local Barnes & Noble, every time I go frequently to Barnes & Noble, and they've just started asking, do you need a bag today? And I'd say 9 out of 10 of the people, because they're books, that's, you know, usually is a fairly easy thing to carry out. You know, it's not necessarily grapes at a grocery store, but they've got to have saved a ton of money from a corporate standpoint and not handing out those bags and giving people a simple choice. So,
absolutely.
More and more people are starting to say, carry your own bag, bring your stuff with you. Let's talk about some solutions and how people are talking about solving the problem of plastics.
Absolutely, because it is very expensive. It's not just expensive for individual businesses that have to buy all these things and they have, you know, their employees handing them out like candy on Halloween. Mm-hmm. That's expensive. It's very expensive. And not just that, it's expensive to clean up. It's, you know, an estimated $6 to $19 billion a year to clean up all of this plastic. And that's coming from tourism and fisheries and aquaculture. And the actual physical act of cleaning up, it's expensive. That's not including how expensive it is for individuals and governments because of what it's going to do with human health and is doing with human health and our marine ecosystems. So yeah, we do need to come up with solutions. I know change is really hard and it's scary. And I know that obviously it's going to impact people in different ways. But I think staying positive and optimistic and looking at how creative and smart we are that we can come up with solutions and compromises for this. And if we can't right now, let's work with each other and at least work towards that, right? So I think for me, I think it's important that we first and foremost close the source of the problem and clean up what's actually there. That is humongous. That is a very, very big issue. I mean, as of right now, 80% of our global emissions of plastic are coming from 1,000 rivers, and 20% of that plastic is distributed over 30,000 rivers. And that does include the Missouri and the Mississippi. And so if we can get into those places and close it and clean it up, and there are many options out there, I think the ocean cleanup, they're creating some incredible inventions that are very quickly cleaning up the issue. From there, it's really important that we prioritize and develop and implement measures and strategies and finding alternatives as well that are cost effective for businesses. There are alternatives out there. And if there was a ban, businesses have time, just like they were, or if they're switching their chicken company or they're switching their buns or their bread, they have time to find other solutions. There are reusable options. They're sterile. They're silicone and hemp and bamboo and glass and metal and paper and straw and plant-based and compostable. And obviously not all of them are perfect for everybody, but some people can bring their own. And I feel really pretty strongly that if you just ask for it, like you said, cutting back, I mean, at minimum, just cutting back and only saying, do you need this? And giving the customer the opportunity. These are all amazing opportunities that can be considered. And if those aren't good enough, then let's keep innovating. Let's keep working to trying to find out new things that we can do that are cost effective and sterile or convenient for all South Dakotans, not just business owners, not just those in our disabled community and elderly, but everybody. And that is going to take a lot of working and listening to each other and considering people, and the profit, and the planet.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting has been airing the impeachment hearings live. NPR has brought you plenty of coverage and analysis, but on Thursday, directly after President Trump delivered his acquittal speech, we had Lisa Hager and David Wiltsey on the air. They're professors of political science from South Dakota State University, and they helped add some context to what we had just heard. Here they are with Lori.
Welcome, Lisa. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
David, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
We've got a lot to talk about when we look at impeachment as a whole, including comments from Senator John Thune and Senator Mike Rounds about moving forward, doing the business of the nation. But let's talk a little bit about what we've been listening to through NPR's coverage. President Trump very quickly came out and said, we've been through a lot together, and nobody else would have been able to take it except for me. But here we are. We're still standing. And that was sort of the beginning of this, what was sort of billed as a press conference or a speech, but he said very clearly in the beginning, this is a celebration for the president. Let's start with some of your initial thoughts about the overall tone of his time in the White House today. Lisa?
I would say, you know, President Trump came out really trying to first address the acquittal, but I think it then quickly turned into an opportunity for him to talk about everything that the administration had been through, and then really touting accomplishments and trying to give attaboys to individuals within the party for their work, not only in helping him through the whole impeachment process, but just with a variety of initiatives from the get-go with his administration. So I think that's why we saw the speech continue to go on and get off topic with respect to the acquittal.
David, there's a sense of, you know, people have been asking, you know, what's the president's frame of mind right now? And I think you could really see this was a cleansing, a cleansing moment for him to sort of get some things off of his chest. He had notes, but mostly he was ad-libbing this. What did you notice?
Yeah, there's streams of consciousness, and then there's streams of consciousness. This was, like Lisa said, it started off with some of this self-pity. It started off kind of as a normal normal defense that he has raised over the past several months. And then he just went into the stream of consciousness, moving from ad hominem attack back to praising some of his allies back and forth for better part of 50 minutes.
Yeah. There was a sense of relitigation of a lot of things, too. We heard the president say early in this process that he would, you know, he would appreciate the opportunity to speak at the, that was always one of those things where, you know, would the president speak to the Senate? That didn't seem to be a very good, you know, idea. He went back to the election. Like, this is how we were running for office. This is how we won the election. And he went from there through James Comey, through the Mueller investigation, through the phone call, and on to what's happening in Iowa right now in the caucuses. A lot of politics sort of laid out in a timeline. Lisa, it's hard to say right now because we're very fresh in this, but it felt unprecedented to me in a lot of ways. Did this sort of feel like an unprecedented presidential moment to you?
I would say so, just in the way that he approached this acquittal speech. I personally was expecting more of a speech where he would just come out and basically talk about how he was pleased with the outcome and, you know, maybe some of this, thank you for your support, thank you for the work that you've done to his fellow partisans, but not to necessarily go into detail with respect to all of the things that his administration has been through, and then, like, more importantly, attack a variety of individuals like Nancy Pelosi from the Democratic Party, or even those from his own party, like Senator Romney, who did vote in favor of the article of impeachment.
Right. Yeah, this was pretty remarkable. We had him directly question and attack the religious beliefs of two people in a moment where most presidents, I would have thought, would try to reconcile this rift in the country that brought us here in the first place. I mean, like you said up front, there was no attempt to really move forward here. There was no attempt to move beyond what's happened over the past few months. We just saw ripping open old wounds, pouring salt in those wounds, more of what we've learned that this is the normal for this president.
And you specifically mentioned his attacks on people's religions. I wrote down, he basically said that Mitt Romney used religion as a crutch. He had never really done that before. He called him a failed presidential candidate there. He's referring to Senator Romney's statement that he made the decision to vote with the Democrats because of his faith. And then he questioned whether or not Nancy Pelosi said, "I doubt she prays at all." He kind of left open for if she was praying, because she was the one who had said, "I'm praying for the president. We need to pray for the president." He said, "I don't think she's praying for that. She's praying for the opposite. If she prays at all, I doubt she prays at all." So religion found its way into this celebration as well. I mean, you could argue that Mitt Romney and Nancy Pelosi did their share to put it there by their comments about their faith. But the president was not shy about attacking that personally.
Right, and this is coming off the heels of this morning's National Prayer Breakfast, which in the past has always been a place where representatives, senators, other politicians come together on a common ground and, you know, try to look past these sorts of narrow partisan and political squabbles. And today it was just used as another opportunity to drive a wedge between himself and anyone that is allying against him.
And I'm wondering about this sense of release and the sort of cleansing. You know, we mentioned sort of the stream of consciousness. He talked openly about the pain that it caused and, what the impact has been on his family, what the impact has been on, people in Washington in general. Do you think, Lisa, that, the supporters of President Trump who have felt this, I mean, everybody has sort of felt the pain of impeachment from either side. People have been disappointed by the process. They've lost faith in, the process altogether. You just hear people's frustration. He's reflecting that frustration from his own point of view. Do you think that people will respond to that in a positive way, to just say, yeah, I needed him to be able to say all that, for the people who really rally around this president?
I think you're definitely going to see that from his supporters and those who are more moderate but tend to lean towards Republican candidates and have supported Trump in the past, specifically during that 2016 election. I think for a lot of people who felt the same way as Trump, as if this was more of a witch hunt, something that the Democrats were pursuing with very little evidence, that it is very cathartic for him to be able to get in front of the national news media and his partisan supporters and talk about how he felt and just go through really everything that he's been thinking over the course of this impeachment proceeding. So I think you will see a lot of people praising him, and I think the way that he approached this speech will be liked by many of those people because it was very conversational, it was very accessible, it was not overly formal. But I think it will elicit quite a bit of criticism from his opponents.
I want to talk about what happens next, because he said, I'll probably have to do this again. You know, I might cross against a light and they're going to impeach me again. Let's talk about, we have statements from John Thune and Senator Mike Rounds saying this is why I voted the way I did. Let's get back to business, John Thune says. How does America get back to business, David, at this point?
It's going to be very, very difficult. If you look at some of the interviews that, or the interview with I think it was CNN immediately after the prayer breakfast this morning, there was even equivocation in Thune's take on all this when he was asked very directly, was this whole subordination of American foreign interest or foreign policy interest to the president's political interest, was that a mistake? And Thune could only come out and say, perhaps, maybe, something that he should have done. I think that was the direct quote. Even when someone like Thune is equivocating at this point on something this important, it's just a sign that this is not going to go away. And these are rifts that are not going to be healed anytime soon.
Senator Thune, in his statement, mentioned the reasons that he voted the way he did. And one of the things he's focusing on again and again is the threshold and how difficult it is to remove a president from office. He says, I'm quoting from his press release, impeachment is extraordinarily divisive and disruptive. It is, after all, overturning the will of the American people by attempting to remove a duly elected president from office. Is the bar that high? Is the bar too high? How do we sort of see impeachment playing into American politics going forward? Lisa, you want to start with that?
My expectation is that you won't have additional attempts to impeach him, at least between now and November. I think the Democrats are going to switch gears and start having their message be, the election's coming up and this is a chance for the voters to have their say with respect to whether President Trump should remain in office. So I don't necessarily think that he's correct in his assumption that they're going to continue going after him. We'll have to see what happens if he would in fact be reelected and if there is any sort of behavior that could be seen as questionable, like what we saw with respect to Ukraine.
Yeah. David Wilkie, for people who believe that he should have been removed, that's one of the things that you hear, which is this is damaging to what a president, any president in the future, is now allowed to do because that bar is so incredibly high.
Yeah, we have a very high bar when it comes to removal of the chief executive. Most other countries, most other democratic countries, I should say, make it much easier for the legislature or some other body to come in, party, to remove a president who or a chief executive that's been behaving like this. The framers set this thing very high, but they also envisioned an office that was much weaker at that particular moment in our history. So we're kind of stuck with this situation where even when you have a broad acknowledgement, like we've seen within the Republican Party, that there's some very serious impropriety here in this Ukraine affair, that they're just unwilling to take the political chance of siding with the impeachment.
John Thune also says in his statement that it's up to the voters, and not the voters wouldn't want a bunch of Washington politicians to make this decision, and then Senator Rounds and Senator Thune go to point out really how seriously they took the task at hand in the Senate, how many interviews they listened to, video that they saw. So you have this sort of parsing of words to say, we know that you don't want us to be making this decision. We're just a bunch of Washington politicians. On the other hand, boy, we really took this seriously. Do lawmakers have, on both sides, have a challenge to convince voters in their home districts that they weren't just following their party?
I don't think the districts matter, really, per se. If you look at this, this was about partisanship driving people's opinions and the legislators' opinions on this. This is really kind of an irresponsible statement on their part. The framers put this into the Constitution for a reason. And they're just not willing to take this role seriously. And you look back at the times that impeachment has been used, it has devolved into a partisan question. Mitt Romney did become the first sitting senator to vote against his party's president in an impeachment proceeding. So from the very start, even when we had the impeachment of President Johnson, which, he was clearly breaking the law, the party and the partisanship overrode whatever kind of public interest that the framers themselves were trying to protect by putting impeachment into the Constitution.
Any other thoughts on what you heard today that you think are significant that we should pull out for listeners to really consider thoughtfully, no matter, once you get past the emotion of your love or distrust or hatred of any of these people in Washington, did you hear something today that makes you pause and say, this is something to chew on back here in South Dakota on how we move forward?
I think the one thing that's interesting is we have President Trump coming out here talking about how he's not guilty, he didn't do anything wrong whatsoever. This was the Democrats just basically latching onto something and trying to carry it all the way forward through the impeachment process. But if you do listen to some of the Republicans that have made statements regarding the impeachment, they're saying things along the lines of, well, some of his conduct wasn't necessarily appropriate. They kind of dance around the issue. So you see a difference in how Trump views his behavior and how the senators view his behavior. So there's not even entire unity throughout the party on how they're viewing what occurred. So I think that's just something to take into account as being interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah. David?
And if there's one thing that I would want people to think about is I'd want them to step back and look at this from an institutional perspective. Examine the Constitution, examine the Federalist Papers, examine some of these founding documents. Try to think about what these mechanisms and why these mechanisms were put in place in the first instance. These were put in place to protect the public interest, to protect abuse of power. And think about this from the perspective of having either party being in the White House. Would you like this kind of behavior on the part of the other party? I mean, this is why we have these things in place in the first instance. This is why the framers put these checks. And impeachment is the ultimate check and one of the only effective checks on the president in the area of foreign policy. So I'd really ask people to think about the foundations of the Constitution and why these things were put there back in 1787.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thanks for listening.